Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Politics on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Bill Scher. Today, we're talking to one of the co-authors of the new book, Fat Cat, the Steve Mnuchin story, published by Strong Arm Press. David Dayan, thanks so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I think Steve Mnuchin is a fantastic subject for a book. There's so much craziness that goes on in the Trump presidency that it's very easy to overlook various policy issue areas and individual figures in his administration. And the Treasury Department is no small department, and yet we talk very little about what's going on there. So I was interested in the subject. What compelled you to delve into his story?
Yeah, I think something similar. I mean, this is a guy who was kind of anointed as financial royalty just by virtue of his lineage. His dad was a partner at Goldman Sachs. His brother was a partner at Goldman Sachs. And of course, he becomes a partner at Goldman Sachs. And he just kind of jumped through this whole world. Elizabeth Warren famously called him the Forrest Gump of the financial crisis. He was involved in mortgage-backed securities, which was one of the central elements of the crisis. He then bought a failed bank and engaged in that bank that he bought, engaged in a lot of the dicey practices in foreclosure operations. And he somehow skates away from all of that and then gets put into a position where he is now supervising the very actors that, like him, brought us to the brink of crisis in 2008. And so it's a fascinating kind of 360 that we get to look at here if you really delve in to his life and times. And so that was really a motivating factor. And obviously, you know, anyone that has an interest in these kinds of issues, financial issues, knows the importance of the Treasury Department. And so seeing not only who the man is that is running it, but what the policies he is putting forward that have the potential to either trigger another financial crisis or at least enrich those who perpetrated it the first time, I think is incredibly important. So it was a combination of all those factors.
Now, this may go a little bit beyond what you're able to delve into in the book. And I do want to get to a lot of the book specifics. But I was always struck when he was first chosen because, on one hand, Trump ran as more of a populist and was very critical of Wall Street, tried to tie Hillary Clinton to Wall Street. Then he picks a consummate Wall Streeter, which is sort of a common criticism of Trump, that he turned around and turned his back on all that type of populist arc from the campaign. But also, if you're going to pick a Wall Streeter, why this Wall Streeter? I mean, you mentioned in the book that several other people say he's not the sharpest knife in the cabinet. This is a fairly sensitive position. You don't want someone who's all thumbs to be head of your Treasury Department. Do you have a good sense of what the logic was behind him getting this very plum position?
Well, I would say that, as we know, Mnuchin served as the finance chair for Donald Trump's campaign. And so he was able to be sort of in close proximity to Trump throughout that time. And what we know is Trump likes people who like him. And if Steven Mnuchin is good at one thing, it's sycophancy. He has time and again defended Trump, even if he, you know, doesn't agree with him, or if the statements Trump is making are insane. He has gone to the mat for Trump over and over and over again. And those are the kind of people who seem to rise through the ranks of the Trump organization or the Trump White House. And so I think it's almost as simple as that. But you're absolutely right. In terms of Mnuchin having a kind of reputation for being a bit of a dim bulb. I mean, we saw this kind of recently when Mnuchin puts out a statement. This is around December 2018, when the stock market is very volatile and it's dropping a little bit. He puts out this statement saying, "I just spoke with the heads of the top six banks. And they've assured me that we have ample liquidity for all operations in the United States." Well, nobody was asking that, whether we had ample liquidity or not. And all this did was cause more consternation and anxiety, because this is the kind of thing you would ask if there was an imminent financial crisis, and there wasn't one on the horizon. So Mnuchin, in effect, created a crisis just by assuring people about something that people were already assured about. So that I think is a mark of this tendency to maybe not be Wall Street's, you know, best and finest. But as long as he is in Trump's good graces, he's probably likely to stay there.
Well, let's get back to the book. You do go to the beginning. And I think, as you referenced just a few minutes ago, Steve Mnuchin isn't just a Goldman Sachs veteran. He comes from a family of Wall Streeters. How would you characterize the Mnuchin origin story?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is someone, as I mentioned, whose father was a Goldman Sachs partner who ran the trading division. His brother was a partner. He got there a few years before him. His grandfather founded a yacht club in the Hamptons. So, you know, I mean, the Mnuchin lineage is long and it runs in those elite circles. Mnuchin at Yale, his roommate was a guy named Eddie Lampert, who ended up working at Goldman Sachs, of course. Both of his roommates did. And then Lampert split off, started a hedge fund, and bought Sears, which is now on the brink of liquidation, thanks to some of Lampert's financial engineering. So even, you know, it kind of distinguishes the circles that Mnuchin ran in, which all had to do with finance and the industry. Mnuchin had an internship, essentially, when he was before he got to Goldman Sachs, which was a summer internship at Salomon Brothers, which was in that time in the 1980s. Creating the mortgage-backed security. So Lou Ranieri was the main mortgage trading desk figure at Salomon Brothers, and he figured out how to turn mortgages essentially into a tradable instrument that and steal market share away from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac in the secondary mortgage market. These were the stirrings of what led really to the financial crisis. The buying and selling of mortgages that fueled a bubble and eventually a collapse. And Steve Mnuchin was a summer intern as they were figuring all this out. So it's just amazing to see where, you know, he landed in all phases of this. He ended up becoming someone who was running mortgage operations at Goldman Sachs around the time that they were engaged in what has come to be known as the Big Short, where they were shorting the housing market and, you know, allegedly lying to investors about the quality of the mortgage-backed securities that they were offering to them while taking the other side of the bet. So you almost can't find a major scandal within particularly mortgages that Steve Mnuchin wasn't connected to in one way or another.
So you mentioned in the book, and you just mentioned that he had a early relationship with a guy named Kevin Lampert. Lampert is involved in the demise of the famed department store Sears, and that is bringing him back into contact with Mnuchin today, correct?
That's right. So, you know, Mnuchin, as I said, was Eddie Lampert's roommate. Eddie Lampert showed up at Mnuchin's confirmation hearings. They obviously have a close relationship even to this day. Mnuchin served on the board of Sears for about a decade. He, in his most recent financial disclosure, it was found that Mnuchin profited from the hedge fund that Eddie Lampert runs. He also profited from a group called Seritage, which it was a split of the real estate assets of Sears. They went into this separate corporation, and then Sears, the company, had to lease back the stores it once owned from Seritage, which was created by this split. Mnuchin was invested in Seritage, made a lot of money with Seritage. So all of these financial engineering kind of operations is what destroyed Sears. And Sears now, it looks like it's going to be liquidated. And the Sears pension will end up in the hands of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. And it will, you know, they'll have to determine whether pensioners will get paid out in full or not, or whether creditors, of which Eddie Lampert is one of them. It's a weird situation where he's the CEO of the company and the chairman of the company, and also one of the top creditors of the company because his hedge fund was lending money to Sears. So the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation has a three-person board, and one of those members of the board is the Treasury Secretary, and that's Steve Mnuchin, who invested something like $26 million in Eddie Lampert's fund and was on the board of Sears for 12 years. And now he gets to make the decision about Sears pensioners and whether or not the creditors, including his old roommate, will be made whole. So it's, you know, just a remarkable situation. Mnuchin said at his confirmation hearings that he would recuse himself from decisions involving Sears. However, he never put that in writing. Some senators have asked him if he would formally recuse back in October when it looked like Sears was headed into bankruptcy and maybe liquidation. Mnuchin never responded to that. So it remains to be seen whether he will actually be calling the shots in some any way on this pension issue.
One of the things that I find is difficult for the average news consumer to follow is to what extent is the Trump presidency actually impacting policy? You know, pronouncements are often made. Big talk often comes out of the president himself. But on a, you know, issue-to-issue, rule-to-rule, regulation-to-regulation basis, what's actually becoming policy and being implemented on the ground? Because lots of things, the rule doesn't get finished or gets blocked by the courts. You in the book do talk about, you know, what actually is happening in the Treasury Department and how much is Mnuchin actually doing to carry forth, whether it's his agenda or the president's agenda or whoever's agenda it really is. How would you say Mnuchin has been, how successful has he been at actually changing the regulatory regime of the Treasury Department's relationship with the banking community?
Yeah. So as you know, this takes time. It takes time to write the rules, to do the various administrative procedures that you need to do. But progress, I would say, is definitely being made, and it's being made on a few fronts. I mean, first of all, what we know about the regulatory arena is that you can have as many rules as you want, but if they're not enforced, then they mean as much as a piece of paper. And certainly we've seen throughout the financial regulatory space that the rules aren't being enforced with the degree of seriousness that they were in previous administrations. And Mnuchin, as the head of the Treasury and the head of the Financial Stability Oversight Council, is certainly part of that. In his position running the Financial Stability Oversight Council, he has removed from stricter regulatory standards several non-bank financial institutions who were previously designated as potential risks to the financial system. That includes AIG, who you might remember, and Prudential, and I think potentially MetLife as well. These large insurance companies that have, you know, a certain interplay with the financial system and could present a systemic risk, as AIG really did in the financial crisis, but they've been let off the hook. There are a series of recommendations that the Treasury made back in June of 2017 to the financial regulatory system, and a lot of those could be done without the need for Congress to pass any laws. And I would say that the regulatory industry is methodically really going about changing the things that they want changed, starting with the Volcker Rule. The Volcker Rule was intended to ban risky trading from the depository institutions, banks that take depositors' money. They didn't want them trading on those accounts. But there is a proposal now to change the Volcker Rule in line with what the Treasury Department recommended. Part of this puts essentially puts the banks in a discretionary role as to whether the trades that they're making are violating the Volcker Rule. So it's really a fox guarding the hen house kind of situation. There's also a lot of work going on at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is a part of the Treasury Department and is controlled by Joseph Otting right now as the head of that agency. And he used to be the CEO of One West Bank, which Mnuchin was chair of. So they're partnering up again within government. The big thing that Otting is working on is weakening the Community Reinvestment Act. And the Community Reinvestment Act is the law that was put in place in the 1970s to ensure that banks are lending broadly across communities in the United States, including low and moderate income communities. This would reduce the frequency of testing and monitoring for the Community Reinvestment Act. And it also would weaken a lot of the standards for the CRA. So those are two major areas, and there are many others where this is, you know, at least moving towards really having an impact. And I would say, as I said before, that when you're talking about regulatory enforcement, certainly we've seen a downgrade in this administration.
We're talking with David Dann, co-author of the new book, Fat Cat, the Stephen Mnuchin Story, co-authored with Rebecca Burns. David is also the author of the book Chain of Title and an investigative fellow within These Times and contributes to The Intercept, The New Republic, and The Los Angeles Times. In the course of writing Fat Cat, you noted that he has said that the Trump administration supports the reinstatement of Glass-Steagall, which has long been a push by Elizabeth Warren and other economic populists on the left to separate commercial banking from investment banking. That law was repealed in the Bill Clinton administration. Has Mnuchin done anything to date to follow through on that campaign pledge?
Absolutely not. And in fact, this was one of the more amazing and maybe revelatory moments, I think, in the book. So there was this hearing in the Senate Banking Committee in May of 2017. And as you know, Elizabeth Warren sits on that committee. And she started asking Steve Mnuchin about Glass-Steagall. You know, Warren has actually written a bill called the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act. So she was asking about whether the Trump administration supports that bill. And Mnuchin has said that they support a 21st century Glass-Steagall, but they don't support the part where commercial and investment banks would be separated. Now, this is entirely what anyone means by Glass-Steagall. That's pretty much what it does, is separate commercial and investment banking. And Mnuchin said, you know, Warren's like, well, this is crazy. You're saying that you support a 21st century Glass-Steagall, but not the part that's Glass-Steagall. And Mnuchin said there wasn't a reversal. He says aspects of it make sense, but we never supported a full separation. But that is the heart of Glass-Steagall. So it was this almost bizarro world hearing. And that's really the last we've heard of it from the Trump administration. There was some indication that what they meant by Glass-Steagall was a separation in regulations between community banks and big banks. Which meant that in their conception, Glass-Steagall just meant deregulation of the smaller banks in the sector, which is kind of par for the course, I would say, for this administration.
So you also note in the book that one of the banks that Mnuchin was previously involved in, run by him, has now been hit with an 8-figure fine for stealing from the government, which I would think if this was any other administration and at any other point of time, like that in itself would be, you know, a weeks long scandal, would probably lead to the ouster of the Treasury Secretary. Can you tell a bit more about that backstory and why do you think this hasn't become something that is widely known about him?
Right. So One West Bank, I mean, maybe it's just because there are so many violations that One West Bank engaged in that the latest one just doesn't raise an eyebrow. But One West Bank was inaugurated after it was a failed bank called IndyMac that was a subprime lender. And Mnuchin bought, you know, along with a consortium, he kind of brought together through his hedge fund, and they purchased One West Bank, renamed it from IndyMac to One West, and they acquired the portfolio from One West Bank, and that included a few things. One was just loan servicing for a number of subprime loans, which they then moved to foreclose on with rapidity using some pretty dodgy practices. That's actually not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is a reverse mortgage arm that was part of IndyMac that went over to One West called Financial Freedom, which, again, when there were failures to pay on these reverse mortgages, Financial Freedom often moved to foreclose, even though what we're talking about is a failure to pay is things like property taxes and homeowners insurance. In a reverse mortgage, typically it's the company that pays the borrower. But in this case, they would move to foreclose very quickly. Financial Freedom, according to some data, was responsible for 39% of all reverse mortgage foreclosures, while only 17% of all reverse mortgages. So they were more trigger happy than everybody else. And there are stories about, you know, foreclosing on 103-year-old women after they lapse for 1 month, or foreclosing over a 27-cent underpayment. These are some of the examples of what happened. And so, yes, during the Trump administration in 2017, the Justice Department did a $89 million settlement with Financial Freedom, saying that the company actually ripped off the government. because what it did was it was getting federal insurance for these mortgage foreclosures on these reverse mortgages that were unlawful, that were done in an illegal way. And so you have this situation where the Treasury Secretary formerly ran this bank, and it's getting hit with this eight-figure fine for stealing from the government. That's what the fine was about. It wasn't necessarily about the foreclosures. Everybody just sort of moved on, as you said. It was just seen as par for the course. Financial Freedom was receiving these interest payments without following the guidelines that the Federal Housing Administration puts out for how you can recoup insurance. And so, you know, this allowed them to essentially be paid multiple times on the same mortgage. It allowed them to collect insurance and potentially also foreclose and resell the property. So this is probably more the norm than the exception for One West Bank. And we have a litany of stories in the book about the different ways in which One West damaged homeowners and engaged in sketchy or even illegal tactics in order to foreclose. This is just one of them, but it's notable in that even Jeff Sessions' Justice Department thought it was a bridge too far.
Who knew Jeff Sessions was the moral center of the Trump administration? You also touch upon the book that he has not been on the same side as Trump's main trade advisors when it comes to trade agreements with foreign countries. There were some news reports that they had a very there was a screaming match between Mnuchin and Pierre Navarro. Do you have any sense of that dynamic, and to what extent has that does that put Mnuchin far away from Trump and makes him a less close advisor and has weakened his position in the administration? Or is this evidence that maybe all Trump's bluster about trade really isn't as populist as we think it is because he has people close to him that constantly push back on protectionism and are pushing for more free trade?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, I know, as I'm sure you know, there's sort of two minds within, or at least initially, there were sort of two minds on trade within the Trump administration. You kind of had the institutionalists like Mnuchin and Gary Cohn that were more interested on the sort of Wall Street view of trade, which was keep it going and don't disrupt these international trade flows for large multinational corporations. And then you sort of had the populist Peter Navarro, Robert Lighthizer, to a lesser extent, world that was in tension with that. And Mnuchin's kind of the last man standing on that sort of institutionalist Wall Street side. Most of the other Wall Street members of the administration have left, Gary Cohn, Dina Powell, and people like that. One thing I think that this shows is how deeply involved Mnuchin is, or at least wants to be, in all sorts of areas of Trump administration domestic policy. I mean, he was the lead on the tax law. He was taking meetings with Tim Cook of Apple and being a liaison to the Republicans in Congress. He tries to, I mean, there's even reporting that people like John Kelly were annoyed that he was just attending all these meetings and trying to be just sort of at the center of practically everything that was being done. And I think that this trade dust up is sort of an example of that. You would think that the U.S. Trade Representative would be sort of the primary individual involved in running trade policy. But here, Mnuchin, as Treasury Secretary, is trying to get his get himself into that process. And that, I think, is pretty notable. You know, right now, it's a little unsettled where this is going. There are talks. There's sort of a pause on additional trade war issues with China. And there are allegedly talks going on during this 90-day pause. It's unclear sort of what side will win out, but it does show the sort of internal bureaucratic infighting within the Trump administration and really Mnuchin's attempt to aggregate as much power to himself as possible.
You say in the book that even if Mnuchin believes himself to be a clear-eyed technocrat rather than a Wall Street ideologue, most of us understand exactly which side Mnuchin is on, even if he himself does not. Do you think that he doesn't see himself as a defender of Wall Street special interests? He sees himself as the adult in the room? Or do you think that the notion that he's the adult in the room is he knows that that's a fiction and that he is purposely taking a political stance on behalf of his favorite constituency?
I mean, I think the last place I want to be right now is inside Steve Mnuchin's head. So I'm not sure that I totally want to answer this question, but I do think that he just has a view of the world that is informed by his history, his lifestyle, his connections, and who he associates with. And that view of the world lines up with sort of a very pro-Wall Street, pro-finance worldview. You know, it's certainly possible that he sees that as an adult in the room. I think that we've seen examples of this throughout recent history, that the sort of technocratic side and the side that argues for more and more financialization kind of sit in the same area. But, I prefer to look at what is the implications of his policy choices. What does it really mean to people in the real world? And I think what we know is that what Mnuchin has been pushing for would mean more deregulation, more risk in the financial system, less enforcement of wrongdoing, and ultimately the threat of another financial crisis. You know, one of the things we mentioned in the book near the very end is that there was this study that came out of the International Monetary Fund, of all people, not exactly, you know, a totally left-wing set of ideologues. And it was this report that looked at what happened after financial crises across the developed world. For the last three centuries, it looked at these financial crises, and it said that this sort of operates like a pendulum. So after the years sort of before a crash, there's a rapid swing of deregulation, and then there's a crash, and the pendulum swings back into a place of building up safeguards and regulations into the system. And then memories fade, and there's a swing of the pendulum back toward deregulation. And we're now on that backswing. And Mnuchin is really at the forefront of that. You're seeing that regulators are more and more captured by these financial interests. They come from Wall Street. They're more forgiving of what is going on there, and it puts the country and really the world in a more precarious situation. And so whether Mnuchin thinks that's just common sense or whether he's actively and deliberately rewarding his pals, the effect is the same. And the effect is really dangerous.
If I could bring us back to where we started, we talked a little bit about why would Trump pick him? Do you have any insight into why Mnuchin picked Trump, given that where his worldview was shaped and whose interests he seems to look out for, that seemed to clash with where Trump was going from the get-go? If you want to get into, he wasn't someone who was in presidential politics in the first place. He didn't have much of a political pedigree. If you want to break into it, why didn't he go with a Jeb Bush or a Marco Rubio or a Chris Christie? Do you know why he sought out Trump in the first place?
That's a really interesting question, and it's hard for me to fully answer. But I know that there has been reporting that has asked Mnuchin sort of that very question, and he sort of answers flippantly and says, "Well, I'm here, aren't I?" It's possible that a man with Mnuchin's pedigree and intellect wouldn't have gotten very far in a Jeb Bush theoretical administration. He might have gotten some assistant traveling secretary job, but not the Treasury Department top slot, right? But Trump was someone who was didn't have those connections to sort of the historical conservative pro-deregulation circles. And he was able to rise through the ranks much more freely and easily there. But it's a really good question to ask because, you know, a lot of Mnuchin's personal donations were to Democrats. He gave to Kamala Harris. He gave to the California Democratic Party. He lived here in California in the last several years leading up to his rise as Treasury Secretary. So why would he choose Trump? And it's a little unclear how the two of them really got together. But I would suspect it was a situation where, especially looking at how much Mnuchin craves and desires power at this point, he saw it as a purely transactional kind of situation where, hey, if I go with this guy and he breaks it, I'm going to be able to be in a position that's much higher than if I went with sort of a more traditional campaign. So that could be part of it, but it's a very good question to ask.
The book is Fat Cat, the Steve Mnuchin Story, published by Strong Arm Press, written by Rebecca Burns and David Dayan. David, thank you so much for being on New Books in Politics.
All right, thank you.